Hi, I'm David Korn.
And I'm Jim Pinkerton. And together,
we're bloggingheads.tv. It's been a while.
It has, it has.
You know, since then, we've seen America become a socialist nation, according to some. We've seen David Letterman yield to Sarah Palin.
And we've seen a big comeback for Sarah Palin.
And they come back. We've seen a Supreme Court nominee.
I don't know,
we talked about that. Who would be the first Latina on the court?
A wise Latina.
I would hope so. Although Nixon once said, you know, what is it about Carswell? One of his Supreme Court nominees who didn't make it. Someone said to Nixon, "Well, he's a mediocre judge," and he said, "Well, even mediocre Americans deserve representation on the court."
That was Roman Ruska, the Republican senator from Nebraska.
Yes. We hope for higher standards these days when nominees get appointed. But we're going to talk about none of that today.
Okay.
That was the anti-tease. You know, this is going to be our all sports show.
Children's photos.
right. But no. I think the story that really is sort of somewhat non-ideological, non-partisan this week, that really is gripping everyone's imagination, is the election in Iran. It's another moment that, you know, that makes the world kind of stop for a brief amount of time, maybe longer, and pay attention to what's going on elsewhere. And there's drama, and people, you know, there seems to be a clear right side and a wrong side, and no one knows what's going to happen. And it really, you know, from a policy side, things that you and I care about, it really calls, well, I think creates all these conflicts. Should American foreign policy be decided on the basis of morality, human rights? Should that be our lead, or should it be on our, you know, our strategic interests? What do you do? And with Iran, it gets even dicier, because were President Obama to follow John McCain's advice and come out, you know, squarely on the side of the reformers and protesters and the opposition, and declare I stand with them, it wouldn't help them. It really wouldn't help them. I mean, John McCain is bonkers on this point. I mean, anyone who knows anything about the history, particularly of Iran, but just where, you know, or just how things work in other parts of the world beyond our border, would realize that a wholehearted embrace and hug from Barack Obama would be the kiss of death. You know, think of Michael Corleone in Fredo, Godfather Part II. We'll get to movies later. You know, it would just be the kiss of death to the opposition movement. Already we see this week Obama saying we're not getting involved, and nevertheless Tehran says the great Satan is meddling in internal affairs in Iran, and certainly historically that's been the case. So I mean, I think we feel, at least I do, these competing urges between going out there and saying, yeah, I'm with you, man, woman, everybody else, and saying, wait a second, I don't want to blow your chances here.
Right, I agree with that. And I think the one group that can't say much of anything about this is the U.S. government, for exactly the reasons you said. Nothing would make Ahmadinejad happier than to reposition this election as, instead of him versus Mousavi, but instead being him versus the United States. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I mean, I, like you, like any other believer in free speech and pluralism and democracy and so on, you can't help but be filled with admiration for these young people protesting, and it does create a dilemma, as you also suggested, for Obama, because it's sort of Obama's speech in Cairo a couple weeks ago was sort of a triumph of sort of neo-Kissingerian realism of, you know, look, we're just going to deal with the governments we have, of starting with Egypt, which is a dictatorship that doesn't even pretend to have elections like Iran just did. And that very moment, Obama seemed to be opening up his fist or his hand, if to use that metaphor from his inaugural address, to not only Egypt and Syria, but also to Iran. Now the Iranians have, through the odious nature of their current leadership, made it all the harder for even a cynical neo-Kissingerian realist to communicate with them. And furthermore, the protests suggests that maybe the current regime in Iran isn't nearly as stable or as popular as we might have thought. So there is the chance that, you know, some sort of you know, fill in the blank revolution, you know, velvet, cedar, you know, orange,
the green revolution,
could come along and topple this government. Although frankly, I doubt it. My colleague,
yeah, but and you also have to think, if you're Obama, if you're just, you know, a reasonable citizen of the United States, you know, about short term versus long term objectives here. It'd be great if, you know, with one push from Washington or any place else, this opposition could, you know, overthrow the mullahs of Tehran and Ahmadinejad. That doesn't seem to be the case, at least not today. And so the question is, this shows that there are millions of Iranians who don't buy the current regime. Now, most of them all support the nuclear energy program that we know that is our biggest bone to pick with Tehran. It's not as if they're going to get in there and say, we don't want this program. I mean, but it's our long-term objective here, particularly if we can't stop Iran from developing nuclear energy systems that can be used, perhaps, to develop weaponry. Our long-term goal is having an Iran that's just more reasonable. You know, we don't get into a tizzy about India's and Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. There are a lot of nations around the world that have them. And so, you know, so if you can't stop this from happening short of going to war, and I don't think, you know, going to war seems to be the answer right now, then the long-term interest is making Iran into a more reasonable state. And it seems that there are millions, if not a majority of the population there, that wants to move in that direction.
Right, and I'm not sure it's the majority. These protesters are up against the accusation that you hear a lot in the media that, look, this is college students and sort of the upper middle class, yep, in Tehran, and that the proletariat, if you will, or yep, and the rural areas, mm-hmm, are solidly, right, in the incumbent government's corner. Now, I don't know that. I mean, right, my colleague here at the New America Foundation, Patrick Doherty, wrote a piece in which he said, look, most likely, Ahmadinejad won the election. Now, again, you have a controversy about...
A big controversy, and I'm on a listserv that Gary Sick runs, who used to be in the NSC during the Jimmy Carter days, in which experts of various political, ideological backgrounds have been arguing this point quite ferociously. And there are some people make the argument that Ahmadinejad could have won, but that they still fixed it before they even knew the results.
Right.
And so, you know, which seems to me to be at least a reasonable possibility. So, yes, we don't know, but whether it's majority or 40% or 38%, but it's whatever it is, it's a significant block. And it certainly, you know, as you just mentioned, includes a lot of, you know, what you'd call thought leaders, middle class or people, student, you know, the students and others. And, we should be playing to them.
Right.
We should be playing to do whatever we can to increase their influence, and that may not be by supporting them explicitly, and it may have to be, you know, taking some sort of, you know, standoffish position in a way that sends a signal that over the long term we're on your side and we want to see this continue. It's very difficult, but the thing that, you know, that gets to me is, you know, it was just, you know, you know, in the last few months, over the last couple of years, the number of prominent neocons, you know, Norman Podhoretz among them, who've called for bombing Iran. And now these same folks out there saying, we stand with the Iranian people. Well, they wanted to bomb the Iranian people, you know, and go to war with them. I mean, we get so caught up sometimes in looking at the government of a nation, particularly one that's easily characterized as is one headed by Ahmadinejad, as being a true representation, or really being a stand-in for an entire nation. And the great thing, I think, about the past week is that, you know, Americans are reminded, as are people throughout the world, that Iran is, you know, a large nation with different views, has a tremendous cosmopolitan class, a professional class, and it's not just a cartoon enemy.
Right. As David Ignatius, writing in the Washington Post, said, you know, look, the Iranians want to solve this problem themselves. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that is, again, the key self-discipline that America has to impose on its own citizens is, look, to the extent that Americans get involved, that will probably help the anti-American forces. And as you said, we could regime change Iran, not that I think we ever really had the capacity to do so, but if we could, we'd discover that the small D democratically elected government of Iran probably also wanted a nuclear energy program. Mm-hmm. And I'll even go further and say it's not really a nuclear energy program, it's a nuclear weapons program. In that neck of the woods, in that region, with Pakistan and Israel and having nuclear weapons, and Russia not being that far away, and China not being that far away, and lots of enemies all around, it is in the obvious political interest of any country in the region to either have nuclear weapons, like in Iran, or try and bluff their way to having people think they had them, like Iraq, and add to that list other countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, and you've got a pretty long list of countries that probably one way or another are going to be in the nuclear club in the next 10 or 15 years, no matter what their government is.
Yep. No, I think you're right. And, Bill Odom, the general who used to run the National Security Agency under Ronald Reagan, who died last year, was very strong on this issue, wrote a number of op-ed pieces saying, listen, we just might have to accommodate ourselves to an Iran with nuclear weapons. And so, the emphasis should not be on preventing that, because it probably is unpreventable if you're not willing to really go to war and take over the nation, which, as you saw in Iraq, is kind of a difficult task.
Which is why we should be for missile defense.
Well, you always come back to that.
We
have other topics. People, you go. You can Google it.
I put the links up.
But that was, it's a realistic view in some ways. And it's hard for Obama to come out and say that, because you'll get beaten up by conservatives and hawks for being realistic. But again, I just will, repeat my first point that our long-term interest is to have an arc in Iran that makes it, a more reasonable state, so even if it had nuclear weapons, there'd be less to worry about. We always should worry, and I'm for zero nuclear weapons and disarmament, but that is probably our better long-term strategy than to, go to war over this.
I agree. Less war, more Twitter.
Yes. Well, as a Twitterer, a tweeter, I'm quite proud, and impressed to see how important Twitter has been. It was really kind of, I don't know what the adjective is. Moving in a way to read the Twitter feed from these students who are trapped at Tehran University when the goons were coming in. And from moment to moment, you didn't know what was going to what was happening. And it's through once again, we're seeing to what degree this new form of media, of telecommunications, of social networking, makes it harder, or can make it harder, for dictatorial regimes to maintain control. The jury obviously is still out on what's going to happen in Iran. But whether all these tools will make it easier. I mean, the way that the Iranian government came in and tried to take away licenses and from journalists, made them stay in their offices to cover the demonstrations only by watching them on state-sponsored media. I mean, they're doing all the sort of traditional things. And I just got an email from a student in London, a PhD student, who has family in Iran, who tells me that the Iranian paramilitaries are going neighborhood to neighborhood, and what are they targeting? Satellite dishes. And they're looking, they're going to the neighborhoods with first with the most satellite dishes, and the repair technicians, the satellite repair technicians, have gone into hiding. Because, that's an easy way to take out that whole system, right? You go for the people who can put it back up again. So it's fascinating, and we'll see to what degree technology you know, triumphs over tyranny, if it can, in this particular episode.
Yeah, I mean as Marshall McLuhan talked about this, I mean, technology does drive things. You know, the medium is the message. And if the media allow for everybody, and that means anybody with an email account or a cell phone, to be part of the media, then obviously you have a kind of pluralism and a diversity and more to the point, a mass that existing systems can't fathom. If 30 million people are, I won't say broadcasting, but 30 million people are communicating, that's pretty darn powerful.
And from what I have read and from my conversations with people who know Iran better than I, you know, Mousavi really wasn't banking on this. You know, yeah, he's a reformist, but he's a reformist within the system and wasn't looking to lead an opposition movement. As of now, the cries in the street are not for regime change, they're for a new election. And things are very fluid. And, of course, I think it was on the Sunday election demonstration. Was it Sunday, Monday? I lose track now. The first big demonstration, Mousavi initially tried to call off. And then when it went on without him, you know, he appeared there. And a lot of this is happening, I think, because of the ease of, you know, of communication that the new forms of telecommunications allow. So in some ways, I'm thinking it's letting, you know, an opposition, you know, find its own speed, regardless of what the leadership wants, in a way. And,
With abundant interaction and feedback to audiences in the West or elsewhere in the Middle East.
And they can at least feel empowered that, imagine some of these lonely opposition movements of the past when if you're in a tyrannical state and you get up there, you know, the guts it takes to unfurl a banner in Tiananmen Square with, 30, 40 years ago, if you think nobody's going to see it at all. And some of the Soviet Jews and others who were protesting in Moscow during the Cold War and the height of the Soviet Empire. I mean, at least now people have, I think, you know, can feel more empowered. And there's the risks, you know, which are great, are more worth taking because you have a higher probability that what you're doing will be seen, will have an impact, and it won't just disappear into some Orwellian vacuum of non-news and of blackout. So, I think it's, causing people maybe to, move faster than they otherwise would. And Mousavi has to, keep up with that now. And, the internal dynamics of the opposition are just utterly fascinating. And, I think, there's going to have to be a calculation at some point. Clearly, the Iranian autocracy is not going to yield. They're not going to, have a recount. They're not going to have a new election. They're not going to hand over power. And they're going to, continue a clampdown. And the way that oppositions, succeed in some ways is confrontation, which involves physical confrontation. It involves violence. It involves bloodshed, unfortunately. And, it involves taking to the streets and going up against the people who would hit you with batons. Gandhi did it non-peacefully. Other places it happens with violence on both sides. And there's no telling yet how far Mousavi, but more importantly, how far the people rallying behind him or in front of him are willing to go.
Right. I mean, when you mentioned your point's well taken about, at least they have a chance. I mean, if you were to hold up a sign protesting the Kim Jong-il in North Korea,
yes,
you'd be gone in 2 seconds, and that would be the last of you. I mean, we should put in a plug for the historian Crane Brinton, who wrote a book, I think, in about 1939 called Anatomy of a Revolution, where he went through the various big revolutions, French, American, I've forgotten the other one, Russian, I think. And his point was they tend to happen when things are getting better. It's a revolution of rising expectations that comes along. And, again, the mere fact that Iran had an election at all, and they've had several, but obviously, if Iran were the sort of death cult that some people in America have called it, where there's nothing but insane nuts, then none of this would be happening. This is a proof of the existence of a civilized, pluralist group, however big, in Iran, and that's heartening for the long run, even if they do become a nuclear power.
Okay, we agree too much, so let's move on. You know, I am losing track of all the big issues that we in Washington and then people across the country, you know, have to think about, contend with. You know, it seems we go from bailing out banks to stimulus packages to bailing out the auto industry to reviving, you know, or recreating a financial regulatory reform system, which was on the agenda as we tape today. And all this stuff is profound. It's deep. It's complicated. There are politics. There are heavy interests on all sides, and it matters a lot. And then, you know, I don't know if this is the mother of all that, or just yet another one of the circles in our 3-5-7 ring policy circus. But then there's healthcare, you know,
right,
which used to stand out alone.
Right.
You know, like in the 90s, and particularly in the beginning of the Clinton administration, it was the only thing for policy wonks to really worry and think about. Now it's like, okay, today is Wednesday, so it's healthcare. Tomorrow we'll do GM. It's like,
right. I mean, it is telling to me,
I should also say cap and trade and climate change.
Right. I think when the history of the Obama administration is written, and I suspect that 2009 will be recorded as the year that both cap and trade and the healthcare plan lost, but we'll come back on that. It's people say, well, what did the Obama people really focus on? And what was really important to them that they did it right away when they had maximum political leverage and maximum, you know, clout and the 100 days period and all that? And the answer will be bailing out banks. I mean, we are going to fight, and you and I, I'm sure, will have a good discussion about how to spend up to $4 trillion, according to the CBO study, on the health care plan. But what's so remarkable is they spent 8 or 10 or 12 billion, nobody really knows.
Yeah, we don't know.
On bailing out, you know, Wall Street and banks and whoever and Europeans and Chinese. So in other words, the money that we're going to fight about now, which helps ordinary Americans, is going to be intensely controversial and may or may not get spent. But we've already kissed goodbye to 8 to 12 trillion.
Well, I agree with you on the bank money, but you know, as we've discussed previously on this show, if you call it a show, on this webcast, on this vlog, is, you know, eventually, you know, probably in time for the next presidential election, there'll be economic indicators suggesting whether things are going in a good direction or a bad direction, and Obama will be able to take credit and say all this ended up working out fine. Or the Republicans will, you know, bash him for wasting all that money. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, I worry about you. I worry politically and as a citizen that it may not turn out well. And that he might have made a fundamental miscalculation at the very beginning by saying, I'm going to go with, you know, with the Geithners and the Larry Summers of the world and try to, you know, prop up the system. And basically, as the plane is landing, or crash landing, perhaps, try to, you know, redo the wings, even if it costs, you know, $9 trillion, and then keep the plane going and then worry about where it goes next, if it, you know, once it regains altitude. You know, I do not believe I have the expertise to say that's good, you know, that is the only, that was the worst way or the best way to go, although I worry it may not work out.
But it was a choice. That was the point.
But it was a choice, and you can see politically that was, you know, perhaps the safe choice, because if you lose with conventional, you know, it's often better to lose with conventional wisdom than to lose with unconventional wisdom, because, you know, more people in the boat, so to speak, as it sinks. So I understand it politically. Doesn't mean I like it. As I often say, I am explaining behavior, not excusing it. But back to healthcare, Obama, you know, again, you know, you think, I believe, my guess is, I don't like making these guesses, is that something will be produced, that there will be a healthcare bill, and, you know, that it will, you know, be expensive and have some, you know, big change, whether it be the right change and go, you know, I'd like to see a public health insurance option. Other people don't. And my fear is that if you, you know, do it bold and big, but you don't get it right, you know, it does make things worse, and it kills reform for the, you know, next 10, 20 years. Plus, you get a big-sized bill to come with that.
And you know,
as in TAB, not in legislation.
You also might get the Republicans taking their vengeance at the polls too.
Well, that's. Listen, you got to say, you got to say this about Obama. There's sometimes when he plays it safe, but other times, he does seem to be willing to be judged, by results. He's not, he at the end of the day, I don't know whether he's going to fight for, a public health option. Right now, he says he will. He's, he went to the AMA and he this week and gave, was very firm on that point. Will he fight against taxing employee benefits? He said he was very firm about that on the campaign. But it seems on both. He might make compromises. Just don't know. But I think he's willing to sign something that's big and if not transformative, quasi transformative. That doesn't mean it's going to be transformative in the right way. And
do you think he can persuade Kent Conrad and all these other big Democrats who say no?
I think at the end of the day, he can make accommodations with them on all these points. I mean, I think it's in their interest to produce something, and they can only argue amongst themselves for so much, for so long, and I think they will find ways, and there'll be compromises, there'll be camouflage, there'll be all sorts of dodges that are implemented into the legislation, so one person can call something an apple, and the other person can call the same thing an orange. I mean, I think they'll cut some of the differences, but that's when I worry that you don't then really address some of the key issues if you make those compromises. But I kind of think that something will be produced. I think most Democrats will want at the end of the day to vote for something. And also remember, there are several Republicans in the Senate who probably want to vote for something too. So if they lose one or two Democrats, they may still be able to pass it in the Senate. Whatever it is.
Maybe. I must say that I think that the tide has turned in the last month or so. I think that the reality of who's going to get their ox gored on this, I mean, it seemed for a while there that the Democrats have spent the last 15 years sewing up big business everybody else, the big players in the healthcare debate who've been on the other side in 1993 and 1994 and brought them around. And now I think that as the details get more finely thought through, hospitals and so on are peeling off. But this has led me to a question, which I've been sort of asking my brothers and sisters in the academic, intellectual, media world of late. And here goes for you. Right now,
I'm glad to be inducted into that world.
Right now, the U.S. spends about 17% of GDP on healthcare, right?
As a thousand. We all
17, 18, 16, whatever the number is, it's in there somewhere. And the question I have to you, David, is if the American people got voting with their feet and with their pocketbooks in secret, could select the number of healthcare. I mean, could raise or increase, decrease or increase the amount of healthcare spending. What do you think they would do if it was all up to them? Where do you think the number would go? Do you think it would be higher or lower?
Well, it depends. Are you talking about them setting a global number, or are you talking about them?
No, for themselves, and then their own personal choice, and then accumulated across the economy and the country.
Oh. I don't know. The number obviously would go up.
But just pick a number. I mean, it's now 17. Say 30, 35, 25?
Jim, I'm not dodging you. I literally have
okay,
no
let's say, let's say
idea.
But you say it would go up. Without hesitation, you say it would go up. Okay?
Well, so, but one thing you're presupposing is that the system stays the same. So to get more we're both assuming that people would want more health care.
Right.
More
health care. People would want more health care.
So you're assuming that the system stays the same rather than making changes that will save money, that would allow more health care at, it may be more effective.
And there are plenty of innovations going on in the health care business. For example, in the 50s, when Dwight Eisenhower had a heart attack, the treatment was bed rest. This is the President of the United States had the best health care available, and they really couldn't think of anything to do for
him. Well, they gave him a pretty good bed.
They gave him a pretty good bed.
The best bed you could get.
15 years later, Yep. The identical heart attack would have been open heart surgery, which is incredibly expensive, incredibly traumatic, incredibly everything. Yep. Now, the solution is stents, which are a lot cheaper. So in some sense, by
pushing
through...
You can almost put them in yourself.
I'm sorry?
You can almost put them in yourself.
And down the road somewhere, you talk to anybody in this business, they'll say, listen, if we keep it up, we'll eventually invent little nanobots that just, you know, go rotoroodering through your arteries and stuff and, you know, just chop away at the plaque and so on and so on. But we're not there yet. But I mean, but that would be really cheap. And after the R&D were done. But my point is, if the American people want to spend more on health care, then why are the Democrats wanting to spend less?
Well,
every Democrat here. I'm sitting here at the headquarters of the New
America. But every Republican wants to spend less too.
I know that. I realize that. But why is it that the two political parties both have positions on health care that are the opposite of what the American people want?
Well, see, but that gets to your earlier assumption that by wanting more, you have to spend more. And what whether this works or not, the strategy is by, you know. Listen, I'm a single-payer guy. I'd like to take, you know, whatever it is, whether it's 1/10 or 25% of the costs that, you know, go to the insurance companies for denying us coverage. We pay them a lot of money to deny us treatment. And just, you know, remove that out and give it to the doctors and hospitals. And use it to cover people that, you know, that aren't otherwise covered. I mean, that's, you know, to me is, you know, you talk about one giant pool. Everybody in the pool. And that would be the most cost-effective way of managing health care dollars. Yeah. At the end of, you know,
maybe it would, but you've got the challenge of people don't believe that the same government that bought us the post office, which brings
The post office for 43 cents or whatever it is now, you can write something on a piece in an envelope, put it in there. Some guy you don't even know, you've never seen before, a gal will pick that up at your office, at your doorstep. And take it across the country in 3 days and deliver it to anybody you wish? I mean, that's amazing!
Well, until you think, well, you mean I could email it for free?
Oh, yes, actually you can, but actually you're not emailing free, you're paying.
I could email on a zero marginal cost.
Yeah.
David, I think you'll agree that to the extent that the national health care is labeled as the post office, it loses.
Well, I understand the demagogic arguments against it. I mean, we trust the government with what's even more important than health care? National defense. We trust the government with that, and they do a good job in some ways and a bad job in other ways. But what I'm saying is, I mean, today John Boehner, they were introducing the Republican plan today, and of course they couldn't tell us what it cost, only that it would cost less than whatever it is the Democrats passed. But nevertheless, he keeps saying, why would you want the government to come between you and your doctor? Well, if it's a choice for me between the government and some of the health care plans I've had, the private health care plans I've had, I say, bring it on. I'll take the government.
Right.
You know, my folks, you know, my dad who died 2 years ago, you know, he did fine with Medicare. The VA system still is one of the best medical systems that we have in this country. So, you know, everything is relative.
David, we're saying different things. First of all, I agree with you that Medicare is popular, and for that matter, the VA is popular. But my point is they're incredibly expensive, and people like it that way.
Right. Yes,
so why is it?
But Jim, you're the fellow who'd be first to say, you know, if Americans want to spend, you know, the equivalent of 30. What are we talking about? $30 billion a year.
30% of GDP.
30% of GDP. On this, that, you know, we can't do that because it would ruin the budget.
I didn't say that.
Well, but you think we should just give? We should do that then?
Actually, I mean, this is what's hit me.
Should we call a doctor?
I mean,
I think workers' comp might cover that. Okay, while you're filming this.
Health care is what economists call a superior good.
Yes.
Okay, this is a superior good is something that you consume more of as your income rises. You know, Rolls Royces are a superior good. You know, by contrast, inferior goods are like, you know, potatoes. As your income rises, you eat less potatoes. Unless, you know. So in other words, there's inferior goods and superior
potatoes.
Goods. And it just hit me. We are the richest country in the world, at least we used to be, and we have an enormous health care bill. And maybe that's a function of the fact that we're a rich country. And so by that reckoning, then, as other countries get richer, they will probably most likely follow our
pattern.
But,
you know, but the interesting thing is, we may measuring national wealth these days is a pretty tricky thing if you don't figure in debt. But nevertheless, if we are the richest country and we spend the most, we're not the healthiest country. Mm-hmm. And survey after survey of countries show that, you know, for what we spend twice as much as the average, you know, Western industrialized nation on health care, and our citizenry, by most conventional measurements, is not healthier. It's less healthier. Our life expectancy and obesity and everything else. Now, you can say these are, you know, these are still, you know, lifestyle decisions or whatever, but, you know, for the health, you know, and maybe without spending all this money on healthcare, we'd be even in worse shape than we are today, and be dying sooner, and be sicker than we are. But the way we're consuming healthcare, putting cost aside, doesn't seem to be in an effective manner either.
You're right. I agree with you, but here's the point.
Good outcomes.
It doesn't seem that the American people want that too. The American people want to spend a lot on healthcare, and they don't really feel like exercising. Now, you doing other things that a doctor would say are vital for your own well-being, like, you know, doing, you know, minimal, you know, moving around, you know, physical, getting back to exercise. So the question is, do we have one party in charge, the Democrats, that says, you know, you American people aren't living your life right, and we're going to use national health insurance of some form or fashion as an exercise in improving your life and making you healthier and doing it our way. And, I guess my response to that is when do you get the message that people are the way they are and they want to stay that way?
Well, you know, people, you know, it seems to be a majority position when the Democrats go after, say, tobacco. Even though there are a lot of Americans who smoke or no smokers. And, you know, sometimes, you know, we talk, you know, conservatives like to make fun of the nanny state, but sometimes people hire nannies for a reason, or physical or personal trainers. And and this is part of the debate we'll see in the next couple of months. But I do think there's, you know, a recognition that however much money is being applied to the healthcare system, it's not producing desired outcomes, even in the way people interact with the system, in the way in whether we feel we're healthier and happier as a nation. And part of, you know, Obama's, you notice, you know, that the sales pitch for healthcare reform has changed dramatically from 1992, when it was covering people, you know, who are not covered. That's still part of the pitch now, but it really is more, if you listen to Obama and the Democrats, it's much more now about, you know, controlling costs and making the system work better for you.
Listen to yourself. But, I mean, controlling costs, and spend less. I mean, I'm just telling you, I think this is the Democrats have let the think tank community talk them into a dead end of where...
What do you think they should be saying, Jim?
Sir?
What do you think they should be saying?
They said saying that people want to spend more on healthcare, they should be able to. And we've got the greatest potential export industry in the world right in front of us. Rich people from around the world, even middle class people from around the world, come here and get healthcare if we stop trying to strangle the industry like we're doing.
Well, I don't think people feel that their interactions with the industry are satisfying.
Okay.
You know, and they find that, you know, a lot of people find that, you know, you know they may want to spend more, but the way the system works now, they are not allowed to spend more.
And I'm telling you that I don't disagree with your analysis of the situation. Mm-hmm. The question is, will the Democratic prescription, we'll call it this, the austerity prescription, will taking what we have now and having less play well with people?
Well, you know, I think to the degree to which you have, you know, I mean, I'd like to see the controls, you know, put down on the administrative side than on the care delivery side. Now, I'm not sure we'll get as much of that as I like to see. That's where you get some money and you put it towards actually helping people. Now, they're talking about controlling costs. They're also talking about raising a hell of a lot of money. This is what the Republicans claim and argue and contend to, you know, fund this system. I don't think, you know, the system, I don't think, at the end of the day, you're not going to have fewer health care dollars being spent. You will hopefully have efficiencies that control spiraling cost in some places, but that overall, I think you're going to end up, I don't think anyone disagrees with this, maybe you do, that you're going to have more health care dollars being spent, but, you know,
I think per capita hopefully in a better way. I think per capita health care spending is likely to fall under the current plan.
Well, we'll see. Well, I'm glad
I mean, but if you're adding 20% of the population to health insurance, you know, including half of them who are illegal aliens, then I think you're playing with fire in terms of you're going to be sacrificing your health care system as it is to pay for an expansion elsewhere. And that's social justice and so on, but it's not popular.
Well, then the Republicans will be able to come roaring back.
Well, that's kind of what I think is going to happen. But my point, though, and I'm just to show that I'm being fair and balanced, to coin a phrase here, is that I think the Republicans are hypnotized by the same idea, which is you have to control health care costs. And their idea is to do it through, quote, market forces, unquote, and through grinding it down on Medicare. And I don't think that's popular either. I think that we have two parties, both of whom are dominated by think tank elites, that say we have to control health care costs, one through the government on the left and one through the market on the right, and I don't think either of them what the American people want.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, as they all say, the devil is in the details, and it depends how you control costs and what you do with those savings. If those savings, you know, actually go back into the system that provide a better level of care for those who already have insurance and those who and provide service to those who don't, then the Democrats, you know, win. If that doesn't happen and people end up feeling like they are sacrificing for the, you know, for the guy next door who may not speak English, then, you know, the third party who capitalizes on this wins. Then, you know, Mike Huckabee leading the American First Party or whatever you want to call it, you know, will have an opening.
Or somebody who just puts forth a Hamiltonian vision of, look, we should be selling American pharmaceuticals to the world.
We do that.
Right, we should be selling.
We do that. There are numerous scandals about it every week.
There's scandals and everything. We should be selling more medical equipment. We should be selling hospital care. We should be franchising. We should be as many American hospitals in foreign countries as there are McDonald's. It's a huge potential industry if you could develop the economies of scale that would lead to this, because as other countries get more affluent, they're going to want the same kind of access to health care that the average American has.
But, Jim, maybe to finish up on this, if the health care industry was in a place where it could do all those things, you know, starting, say, tomorrow, why would we have the problems we have now? I mean they've had a pretty much a free reign for decades now, and they haven't developed these McDonald's style hospitals that you'd like to see. And what they've done is they've created tremendous popular resentment, you know, mainly on the insurance side, doctors don't like the system they're in, patients don't like the system they're in, people who can't afford it are upset because they're not in a system that others, you know, are frustrated by. They've had, you know, the market has been pretty free for a pretty long time, yeah. And yet it hasn't produced, you know, the sort of medical, Disneyland that you talk about that would bring in medical tourists and, you know, produce, you know, McDonald diabetes treatments for export to Indonesia.
Right. The two groups that control healthcare spending in this country now are three groups. Two of them are, one is the government, and they're always looking to control costs. The other is the insurance companies, and I completely agree with you. They're looking to control costs. I mean, you said it well earlier. We pay a lot in premiums to get our health care claims denied. I agree. Yeah. The third group is people themselves, and they do spend a lot of money and seem happy to do so. And that I see as the export market. But the question is, are we doing it right if the two groups that are most account for most healthcare dollars, which is to say, the government and the insurance companies, get to control the process? And obviously, they're against what I'm talking about. They're obviously uninterested in innovation because, in fact, it's cheaper if you die. That's popular with them.
Well, they are.
It's just not popular with the average American.
Well, that's true, and that's listen. You know, you're talking about having a totally private system.
I didn't say that.
Well, we're talking about the energy of a free and a private market.
I didn't say that either. I mean, the example I used of open heart surgery was not. I have no idea who developed all that technology that took us from bed rest to open heart surgery to stents, and further from there to nanobots. But something tells me there's a huge. And I guarantee it, the government role has been played in the rapid evolution of heart disease treatment in the last 50 years.
My point here, though, if I can bring it back to mind, my point is, you don't want the insurance industry or government, controlling the process because they, because you trust neither. So who then controls the process?
I didn't say I didn't want the government controlling the process. What I said was I don't want the government controlling healthcare decisions. What I think the government should be doing is spending money on R&D in a big way on these things. Pick five or ten clusters of issues of which.
Okay, who decides on the pot of money?
Frankly, if I were in the position, to run for office, better.
Well, you always can.
Getting a haircut and so on. I'd go to the American people and say, listen, if you elect me, we're going to have an all-out war on X, Y, and Z disease, and we're going to spend the fortune. It's going to be a moonshot level intensity on this, and we're not going to worry about controlling costs. We're going to worry about kicking this disease in the ass. And I think that would be a popular position. And it would go exactly in the teeth of the austerity mongers in both the Republican and Democratic Party.
But that doesn't get into the question of, who pays for what bills when you're sick with something other than that particular disease.
Well, I mean, there's some, right, some, which, some issues you just...
The healthcare system, I mean, that's R&D and research, you and I are going to agree on this, is fine. But that's really a separate, item than the day-to-day delivery of care and where how do you pay for that, who ends up making the decisions, and... I mean, I'm all for leading a war on the insurance companies.
Okay, take an issue that's become very chronic now in this country, diabetes.
Right.
If there was some better treatment than we have now for diabetes, that didn't mm-hmm. spend so people didn't spend $30,000 a year on dialysis, that would be worth doing.
Of course.
Okay, but that saying that's exactly what's going to get left out of the austerity plans that the Democrats are cooking.
Well, not necessarily.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
No. You're talking about research.
Yeah, but they're going to spend. Obama
has raised the NIH budgets and things like that. There's more money going to cancer research. I mean, that stuff really is separate. I mean,
that's the mistake they're making.
Well, but I still think saying we're going to find a better treatment for diabetes is all well and good, and I'd rather do that than invade Iraq. Fine. You win that point, but it's still the question about healthcare reform is changing the system for delivering care today or tomorrow, or next month. Not finding it's separate from finding new, bold, and better treatments,
which we
need to do.
You might be right, but I'm just saying if you are right, then the Democrats are in big trouble because they're preaching an austerity message.
Well,
they're going to spend less.
Well,
why? The only reason I could think of that the Democrats should be for cutting healthcare spending is the Republicans are for it too. So we have two parties, both of which are kamikazing their way into the teeth of the American people. And I don't. I mean, it's an interesting testament to the power of the think tank media intelligentsia to fool rational politicians into going against their own interest because they'd rather please think tanks than their own voters.
Well, I don't know about that, but I think, you know, offering everybody saying we'll spend whatever we want on anything, and you have to then say, where's that money coming from? Do you have an answer for that?
I do. It would come from greater exports. It would come from creating whole new industries here at home.
So then, you know, these companies that haven't created these systems yet would create these products, sell them, make a profit, and turn out that money would be redistributed.
Just like World War II, the military contractors became civilian contractors. The aviation companies and the electronics companies of World War II became sold to huge civilian markets after the war.
Well, you know, I'm always skeptical when I, you know, hear, you know, technology changes a lot and often provides fixes, but when people say we can do this through technology.
We just got through talking about the Iranian Revolution.
But no one said 10 years ago, you know, we just need better technology and then we'll be able to deal with Iran.
I mean, people have said for decades that new communications technologies, going back to the cassette player in the 70s, which is what helped get the Ayatollah didn't turn out to be much of a Democrat, but the revolution. Yeah. Plenty of people supporting his revolution until they were killed.
Yeah.
Were Democrats, and we all agree that the fax machine and so on. I mean, in the 80s helped, and the Xerox machine helped, the anti-communist groups in Eastern Europe and the Soviet bloc. So, I mean, I think that the record is pretty clear of technology being a transformative thing in the world of politics, just like technology was transformative in military affairs, and technology was transformative.
No, I understand that, and we got Tang as well. Let's not forget that.
We got GPS.
But you know, but sitting here saying that that we can sort of technologically innovate our way to a better healthcare system, it still will depend. Who's controlling what levers where?
Okay, and this will surprise you. I think the government should play a huge role.
Well, we agree on that in terms of R&D.
Right. We agree on that. So the question is why do we agree on stuff that neither political party will say?
Well, I do think that the Obama budget ups research for number of different diseases. So more than and Bush tried to actually I remember Bush trying to talk about that too. So I mean maybe we should. Do it by a factor of 10.
That's what I'm getting at. Doubling it isn't good enough.
If
it's really important to people,
we agree that fighting diabetes is more
important than...
Well, we said diabetes. I'm not sure I'm agreeing with diabetes. Maybe we can pick another disease.
What's wrong with diabetes? You like diabetes?
I don't know. I just, there may be something where we can get a bigger bang for our mega bucks.
Maybe cancer. Who knows what it would be? That's something where the experts, in World War II... President Roosevelt and the other defense leaders.
I would even be willing to raise taxes on rich people for this.
Okay.
I would say, instead of having two poles, maybe you get by with one pole, and we have a moonshot that gets rid of cancer in the next 10 years. Can you live with that?
I had an interesting conversation with Senator Lautenberg of New Jersey on that. On the Acela, the train that runs from D.C. to New York.
Expensive train.
Worth it, in my mind. But anyway, I was asking him about, financing healthcare and stuff, and he said, why don't we have a... I mean, he was sort of talking vaguely, and maybe not even on the... You didn't say off the record, so I'm just saying he wasn't, to my knowledge, this wasn't legislation or something. He was sort of musing aloud about it, and he's, 85 years old, so he's got the luxury of having a certain, indulgence respectful indulgence from people like me. He said, maybe we should extract it out of the inheritance tax. Maybe if you spend a lot of money on health care, the government should keep track of it, and you're on Medicare, for example, and the government should extract it out of your estate in some prorated way. So in other words, you get a more explicit choice. Do you want to spend the money on yourself, or do you want to
pass it on?
Or pass it on. It becomes a matter of choice. I thought that was kind of a surprisingly market-oriented, but it's also sort of sensitive approach to this issue of financing, the kind of what oftentimes is feudal care of somebody's 99 years old and is, you know, gets another hip replacement or something. I mean, those things probably do need some kind of cost-controlling corrective.
And easier to come from a guy who's 85 than from those of us who are still a few years from that. We've gone on a long time. We had another subject. I think we should can it and move right on to the most important subject. You had something you wanted to say on cinematic.
Well, I just thought it was interesting culturally to see that according to the Hollywood Reporter, that MGM United Artists, you know, are remaking the cult favorite 1984 John Milius film Red Dawn. Now, you know, those of us who were laboring in the anti-communist vineyards back then remember this movie starring Patrick Swayze, Jennifer Grey, and Charlie Sheen as high school kids who fight the communists who have conquered, I think, Colorado back then. A movie that was dismissed by critics as idiotic and seen by some of us as allegorical, and, you know...
I think calling it idiotic is not fair to idiotic movies. It helped fuel paranoia. Yes, the Russians and the Chinese, who we know are such good friends, would come together and jointly take over not a town on a coast of America, but right in the middle of America, which is probably very near the NORAD command.
Right.
You think it's culturally significant. I think it's
significant.
You can you name me the director of this movie?
The new one?
Yeah.
Yeah, his name is like Bradley. I mean, like
No. He was like the stunt coordinator on another film.
He's a second unit director, stunt coordinator for Quantum of Solace.
And
some other big movie. I mean, he's obviously a talented guy.
But he's not yet a cultural indicator.
No, he's not. But again, this movie isn't being filmed by Pat Robertson Productions. Yeah. This is out of Hollywood. I'm just saying. I think.
But you know what they say? They one of the rules of remakes in Hollywood is never remake a good movie. It's like because you're.
Hold on. Stop right there. How many times have they remade Star Is Born?
No, that's.
It won the Oscar.
I didn't say it was a rule that they stick to all the time.
Okay, great.
But you don't want to remake a good movie.
They remade all the Pink Panthers.
Yeah, and they're not very good.
Okay, but I'm saying don't do it. I mean, they did it. I will stick to my guns here and say that come 2010.
When America will be gripped by what to do about communism.
When America will be gripped with what to do about Obama's trillion-dollar overspending spree. On wasteful stuff, I think this movie will have a substantially good chance of having a good pop there reaction.
I'll bet you a bucket of popcorn you're wrong. You give me 2-1 odds. I bet she doesn't even make it to the theaters.
All right, let's bet on
straight
that.
Straight to video. Straight to video.
I'll bet you that it gets in the theaters. Anyway. All right, David.
Okay.
It's been an hour. It's been fun, as always.
It's been a pleasure.